You're listening to BQN. Assimilate the audio.
Engage.
78 years have passed since the days of the original USS Enterprise. Now a new galaxy starship has been designed.
Transporter Chief, beam our listeners aboard. Welcome to Galaxy Class, a Star Trek The Next Generation podcast on the BQN. I am your Chief Recreational Officer, Rhea Papagiorgio, joined today by Diplomatic Standard Bearer Kevin Scar... Oh, wait, no. He's off doing clown things. Joined today by Counselor Amy Nelson... Oh, wait, no. She's off in Scotland with our Chief of Scotland Tour Guiding, Joe Keegan. Wait a minute. Looks like I'm all alone aboard the Galaxy Class today. I'm feeling like Dr. Beverly Crusher. I know. Let's beam in a special guest. Listeners, today we have a very special guest, a semi-celebrity, if you might, a friend of the network. You also might have heard him, co-host of Mission Log, The Orville. You also might have heard him if your captain was speaking on a flight recently here in the United States. It's the one and only Captain Mike Richards. Captain Mike, thank you so much for joining us on Galaxy Class.
No, Rhea, thank you for inviting me to come on here and talk to you. I love this podcast network. I've been following you and Amy and Joe around for, I think this is the third network that y'all have been on. And back in the first of the three, I won't name any names, but that was where I first came across you guys and kind of got my start podcasting there also, just through the Patrons Roundtable and then a guest with Haley Stoddard on Standard Orbit. Back in the day, and that's what got me there. And then I was with Amy invited me onto All Good Things following the 55-year mission in 2021. So yeah, great to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Yeah. Well, you know, my motives are entirely selfish because, and listeners, some of you might know, I've sold my house, I'm quitting my job, moving cross country, and I'm going to follow in Captain Mike's footsteps and become a commercial airline pilot. That is the dream, that is the goal. And so I was thinking about, well, what can we learn about pilots, piloting, helmsmen, flying starships from TNG, and who better to aid in that discussion than Captain Mike?
Well, Star Trek has been such a influential part of my life. From the time I was a little kid, just, you know, sitting cross-legged on the floor watching the original series every night. And when I got a little bit older, twice a night, because I could stay up late enough to catch the late one on WPIX in New York, and just watching, you know, Kirk and McCoy and Spock, you know, look at the ethics and the logical side of things and the emotional side of things and make ethical decisions that really are not often perfect decisions, but to always strive to do the right thing, always strive to be better. And not compromise their principles. And that to me has carried over, not just, you know, in life and as a human being and as a dad and as a husband, but also as an airline pilot, because a lot of it is just doing the right thing when nobody's looking, right? Mm-hmm. It's just you and one other person up there and you're in charge, and it would be easy to bend the rules and it would be easy to push your limitations and to push, you know, the policy for the sake of convenience. But every time you do that, you're kind of stripping away layers of safety. And the important thing is to, you know, do the right thing when nobody's looking. And I think Star Trek and Starfleet and the way the values that they always portray themselves as having has gone a long way to inform who I am. So this is going to be, I think this is going to be a great conversation, or at least a conversation I'm very happy to be part of.
Well, I'm so tickled that you're a part of it. And I'm so looking forward to it because, you know, as I've been kind of laying the foundation to chase after this dream, picking, you know, everyone's brain, everyone that I can. And you know, we've had quite a few conversations in the last year. And that's one thing, you know, when you think about being a pilot, you know, you think of Top Gun, you think of, you know, cocky guy with his, you know, Ray-Bans on, or even Tom Paris, another kind of cocky guy known to bend the rules every now and then. But the more I've talked to actual real life pilots, do the right thing when nobody's looking, you know, You don't cut corners. You don't give on safety.
There are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no old, bold pilots. is kind of the old adage. And yeah, I mean, it's exactly like that. It's that, you know, sort of the stereotype, you know, in the Hollywood version of it versus the real life version.
So TNG, you know, we don't have necessarily the hotshot pilot, like, for example, Tom Paris in Voyager or Eric Ortegas in Strange New Worlds, or, you know, everybody loves Gordon from the Orville.
You know, he's been hugging the donkey since flight school. So
absolutely. Can't wait to learn how to do that.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about one of the first times we talked about this. I called into Mission Log Live and was talking about the need to expand the diversity in and among airline pilots. Because when you pick from one particular gene pool, for instance, people are trained alike, they think alike, and then they tend to make the same kind of mistakes. Mm-hmm. And then those errors tend to go untrapped. But when you have people from varying backgrounds that have had different training, still to the same standard, but different types of training that think differently, then they make different mistakes. And then there are some, you can catch each other's mistakes a little bit more more efficiently, I would say. It's kind of like, you know, we often use, it's called the Swiss cheese model to identify catching errors. And, you know, if an error goes through one layer of protection and kind of goes through one hole in the Swiss cheese, but then you have a different shaped piece of Swiss cheese behind it with mm-hmm. different holes, that layer might trap the error and on and on and on. But if you were to line up, you know, thousands of pieces of identical pieces of Swiss cheese, then those errors would go untrapped. So that's why you want, you know, young, you know, some younger people who are starting out that you can train from scratch, and maybe some older people that flew at other places. Maybe some people came from the Navy, some people from the Air Force, some people from the Marine Corps. Maybe you got some people that went to, you know, a Big Ten university to learn how to fly there, and some other people that went to, I don't know, like the SEC, and other people that went to, you know, the Mountain West or something like that. There's right. you know, aviation programs from all around the college, all around the country. And those people all kind of have different backgrounds and different thought processes and look at things from a different way. And they can back each other up, I think, in a much more efficient way than just everybody thinking the same way, which is how, you know, quite honestly, the airlines did things for decades. The pool came mainly from the same place, and the folks kind of thought alike, and the same kind of mistakes were made. So it's great to have the variety. And I remember you kind of reached out right away and you said, hey, would somebody like me be welcome into the airline industry at, you know, with given your, you know, your, I'll say your demographics.
Age.
And I was like,
advanced age.
Hey, you said it, not me. And I was like, we would love to have you. Please, please, please. If you have especially if you have a passion for it, like good God, please go for it and bring your talents to us, because we need them.
And the crazy thing is, it took me a while to believe you, honestly. I remember you telling me that. And you know, in my mind, I'm just like, yeah, right. They don't want someone my age, you know. But like you said, and what I'm coming to see now is, you know, I bring life experiences and I bring mm-hmm. a level of maturity that maybe, you know, someone fresh out of college doesn't have. I don't know. The level of maturity part's kind of debatable. But
yeah, like the old joke, you know, what do you mean? When you grow up and a kid says a pilot, and be like, you're just like, no, you can either grow up or you can be a pilot. You can't do both.
Well, I've made my decision and I'm sticking with it.
Good.
But again, you know, like you've taught me in the last year, it's more than just being a hot, cocky hotshot flying a plane or a starship. The integrity and the character. Technical skills are one thing, but constantly keeping in mind, do the right thing, decision making, risk management, all of this stuff. Yeah, an old person can be an advantage in that.
I think so, 100%. You know, you mentioned Sulu a little bit ago as like the hotshot pilot in the original series, which really that got, you know, kind of brought to light more, I think, during the films. But I had a chance to meet George Takei at Mission Chicago. And so, you know, I stand in line to get his autograph and I introduced myself and I said, hey, I'm a pilot. And, you know, I just, you know, kind of always looked up to you as a helmsman. He goes, oh, who do you fly for? And I told him the airline I flew for. And he goes, what? A disgrace. So many canceled flights, dare I say tens of thousands of passengers stranded. Now, I don't mean to brag, but I'm a United Emerald member. Now, I'm not bragging. It just means I have many, 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 many millions. I don't know how many millions, tens of millions of miles. And they weren't caught up in any of that. There were no delays. I flew from San Francisco on time. No problem. But you, what a disgrace.
Oh, my God.
And I was just like, so here's my $80. Can I still have your autograph, please?
Oh my gosh, you paid $80 for an autograph and a talking down to. That's awesome.
Thanks. It was not just my airline that was in the news that weekend. It was many airlines that were in the news. Luckily for George, though, not United.
That's funny. And you know, to Chicago, I actually did fly your airline and I got there on time. So
good. Glad to hear it.
Yes.
But yeah, pilots in general, you brought up, you know, I mean, just, you know, integrity and character, doing the right thing when nobody's looking, you know, early on as you're starting and, you know, maybe you're a co-pilot or what we call in the industry, a first officer, you know, that's when it's all about building those rock solid technical skills, you know, not just the ability to fly the airplane, but knowing the systems, knowing the rules, you know, building your knowledge base, building those skills, building that experience. And then later you develop more into a leader where you're getting the most of your people, taking care of the crew, taking care of the passengers, setting them up for success, knowing what resources are available to you, whether that be, you know, folks on the ground or maintenance or dispatch or, you know, the people you're flying with, air traffic control, and then be able to make, you know, decisions that keep you out of harm's way. You know, my very first airline, I'm not afraid to say it, you know, from 96 to 2003, I flew for Transworld Airlines, TWA. And I flew with guys that had been all around the world for decades. And these guys had a comfort zone that was just a mile wide and a mile high. And, you know, they would allow you enough latitude to make some mistakes and get some experience and, you know, learn from your own mistakes. On the other hand, they had such a wealth of experience that they could head off, they could smell trouble, you know, 100 miles away and make a 1 degree correction to avoid it. And, you know, I learned from that also, like how to just sidestep a lot of things. So mm-hmm. you're really, as a first officer, as a younger pilot, you're really building those habit patterns and making sure that your technical skills and expertise just grow as fast as they can and as much as you can, so that later on you can make a good leader.
And I think we see in Star Trek, a lot of these helmsmen become future captains, like Sulu.
Yeah. Yep. And I really like that. That is the track that is kind of, as we all know, red shirts in Next Gen in the Berman era. Mm-hmm. They're the command division folks.
Right.
Right. So, and they're also the helmsmen. Yep. The helms people. So they're the ones that are kind of being groomed for future captains. And we know people move around, right? Like Worf was a red shirt in his mm-hmm. first season. So was Geordi. And then they moved into security and engineering. So donning the gold shirt and, you know, moving out of the position of helmsman. But I do like the fact that, you know, Riker, Picard, those folks did come up through that track, because it, I think it just kind of is, it follows that analogy that I've seen from, you know, learning how to kind of operate the machinery to kind of, you know, be in command of it as well as the people. Now, there's plenty of exceptions, right? I mean, in All Good Things, Beverly Crusher was the captain of a medical ship. And also Captain Janeway came from engineering, and I think she was a scientist, if I believe, or
right.
an engineer.
Yeah.
So so definitely different paths mm-hmm. to get there. But I do like the fact that the helmsman is considered more command track than, say, operations.
Right. And that's, I'd never even kind of put that together until, you know, until you brought that to my attention. You know, it never dawned on me before. But that is one thing that I'm excited about pursuing this career is, you know, obviously developing the technical skills and everything, but then moving into a leadership position and, you know, the thought of someday maybe being that experienced captain that's got some rookie first officer that I could have birthed, you know, sitting there, you know, nervous, making mistakes and helping to guide that person. So that's kind of an exciting aspect of the career too, that again, I never would have thought about before you, Mike. So thank you.
Yeah. And at that point you can just kind of slow things down. I mean, there's, you get folks that are new, especially if they're very smart. You know, a recent first officer I had was, you know, really smart guy, really sharp. I think very much wanting to do a good job and very much trying to, you know, basically trying to impress the captain. But there's a certain rhythm to the cockpit, right? There's a certain kind of ebb and flow. And it was just, you know, I just kind of had to build time in. I was like, okay, you're doing great, man. Mm-hmm. Take your time. we're not quite there yet. There's no reason to rush this. There's no reason to jump into this. We've got plenty of time to take care of everything we need. Because when you're rushing, you make mistakes.
Right.
Right. No matter how good you are.
Yeah.
You know, one of my functions is to work in our safety department. So we read reports from pilots when they self-disclose. And it's always the same thing. Got into a rush, made some mistakes. Mm-hmm. Didn't catch it until it was too late. And now I'm writing you this letter so I don't get in trouble. And it's like, okay, cool. In the future, don't rush and you'll be fine. You know, you were talking about the Hollywood pilot, the hotshot, the Maverick, if you will, mm-hmm. or the Nick Locarno.
Yeah.
And I honestly think, you know, one of the best explorations of the pilot dynamic is in the episode First Duty.
Absolutely.
Where, was it Nova Squadron? Is that what they were called?
Yep.
Sometimes I want to call them Red Squad from Deep Space Nine. Nova Squadron. And they tried the Culvert Starburst. Did I get that right? It's been a while since I've seen that one. Okay. Yeah. You can be a kick-ass pilot, and everybody in that group was, but without the integrity and the ability to use sound judgment to make decisions, mm-hmm. you're really putting everybody at undue risk. We talked about the old pilots and bold pilots. Mm-hmm. Another really good quote came from Frank Borman, or at least it's attributed to him. Frank was an Apollo 8 astronaut. He was in command of that first mission with Jim Lovell that circled the moon, that orbited the moon and then came back, but they didn't land. Mm-hmm. And Jim Lovell, who of course went on to command Apollo 13, which, you know, is a famous mission.
Heard of it.
But yeah, I think yeah. And you know, we all know Jimmy could land a washing machine if he had to. he said a superior pilot, this is Frank Borman, said a superior pilot uses his superior judgment to avoid situations which require the use of superior skill. And I like that a lot. That's when, you know, things are, you know, getting a little bit, you know, outside of maybe my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're holding, trying to go into an airport and we're getting, you know, down to the amount of fuel where you can either go there or go to the alternate, but we can't do both.
Right.
Or if you got brought in a little bit high for an approach, and sure, you can get down, but it's not going to be pretty. You just kind of go around, try it again. It's easy, you know. It's what the company wants us to do. It's what the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, for our international listeners, is the governing body in the United States that mm-hmm. both promotes and ensures the regulatory compliance of aviation. And they're here to help. We all know that.
Oh, absolutely. But
that's what they expect us to do. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I think First Duty really kind of hit all of those notes.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, the much maligned Nick Locarno, mm-hmm. There was maybe a throwaway line at the end, but you know, the only reason Wesley and everybody else were able to continue in the academy was because ultimately Nick said, this was all my fault. This was my idea. Mm-hmm. I pressured these guys into doing it in the first place. And then I pressured them into lying about it.
Yeah.
So please put this all on me and I will, you know, bear the brunt of the punishment. So he eventually did come up huge at the end of that episode.
Yeah.
So, you know, while there was some talk about Nick Locarno being an unredeemable character, mm-hmm. and that's why, you know, it got rewritten to Tom Paris in Voyager, I think Nick Locarno was quite redeemable. In fact, mm-hmm. I think he redeemed himself by the end of that episode.
I think so too. I mean, he really ran the gamut in that episode, you know, the cocky hotshot pilot with his mm-hmm. cocky hotshot team, didn't necessarily do the right thing. And well, clearly didn't do the right thing in insisting on the, you know, the starburst maneuver, in the first place. It was a prohibited maneuver. So right there, you're bending the rules. You're not doing what's right when the big dogs aren't watching. And then, you know, knowing that one of his pilots wasn't quite up to the task, and then pressuring to do something he wasn't comfortable with. So he definitely, I mean, he, you know, dropped the ball quite a few times there, but I agree with you 100%. He redeemed himself. He's the reason Wesley was able to stay in Starfleet long enough to quit and that Cedar Jackson was able to stay in Starfleet long enough to get killed, you know? So.
Yeah, let's just say it maybe didn't work out well for most of them. I don't know what happened to the other the other couple or three that were in there as well. Because I think there were six in the beginning, and then there were five, then there were four, then there were three.
Dropping like flies. And actually, on the Tom Paris point, the story that I've heard is that they wanted to bring Nick Locarno back into Voyager, but didn't want to have to pay the royalties.
I've heard that. And then I also heard I actually believe that. Like if you're like, hey, pick one of these scenarios, I would follow the money. But you know, the other theory was that I've heard was that Nick was such an unredeemable character that they didn't want to even use that name. Although I disagree as well. But that leads us to another thing is that you can get away with pretty much anything in aviation unless you lie about it. Mm. You know, if you mess something up, you know, whether it's, you know, entering the wrong flight plan into the flight control computer and maybe, you know, having a navigational error after takeoff, mm-hmm. or flying the wrong altitude, or taking an airplane where maintenance wasn't quite finished on it yet. Mm-hmm. You know, any of those things are mistakes that happen. Not often. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to scare anybody because most of those, you know, can really be pretty minor, but if you fess up to it and don't try to lie about it, then the worst that's going to happen is, you know, you may get a little bit of time off. You'll probably get some retraining, mm-hmm. and then you'll be back at it in a minimum amount of time. But once you lie about it, you're done. I mean, that's almost an unrecoverable situation to be in. So yeah. And I think that's good advice for anybody.
Yeah. That's something as I'm learning more about the profession, something I'm really coming to respect is that integrity aspect. And that is the message of the first duty. The first duty is to the truth. Like you said, you're, you know, helping out the safety office, reviewing self-disclosures. I mean, that's your chance to fess up.
Yeah. And it's a great program. I mean, it's been around since it started with NASA back in, I think the late 70s. With a voluntary disclosure program, and it's been wildly successful. And mm-hmm. you know, airlines around the world, you know, including especially in the United States, have adopted this. And not only is it a way for the FAA and airline operators to learn what's really going on out there, because they hear about things they never would have heard of otherwise, mm-hmm. you know, then they can mine that data to improve training, to improve procedures, to improve the support material that's available to the crews. Because sometimes, quite honestly, it's like, hey, we found ourselves in this situation. We had no guidance mm-hmm. whatsoever. Well, then that can be used to improve the guidance material that's available to us and the resources that are available to us when we're flying. So it across the board, it's been a wildly successful program, not just to get you out of trouble, but also to get a better idea of what's actually happening when nobody is looking, like we talked about.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just setting the stage for Starfleet to continue to develop that program. I mean, NASA's got it in place. I would hope that Space Force has it in place. And then when Starfleet comes around,
well, I know that Space Force logo looks an awful lot like Starfleet.
You know, I mean, where do you think Starfleet got their logo?
Apparently,
the natural development.
This is where it happens.
I know. This is all history. We just happen to know the future. So, aboard the Enterprise D and E, our helmsmen were officially called flight control officers. Like we talked about earlier, some of these flight control officers did stay on the command track. Others took different routes. For example, Geordi. Oh, actually, you said something earlier that made me think of Geordi. You're a first officer trying to impress you. And when Picard first met Geordi, Geordi was piloting Picard's inspection tour shuttle. And Picard had mentioned something about the engine not feeling right or not sounding right or just made a comment in passing. Mm-hmm. Geordi stayed up all night to refit this engine to meet with Picard standards. And Picard remembered that and brought him aboard the Enterprise.
That's awesome. Yeah. And that also kind of reminded me of, you know, later when they were on, I think it was when they were on the E, and the captain said, check something. I feel a 2 millimeter phase imbalance. Mm-hmm. And he was like, before I could hear one, it was one. And I know I got that wrong, but I know our listeners are going to know what I'm talking about with that.
Yeah.
But I tell you, you know, one of the neat things about Geordi, and I think it was really one of the highlights for me of season one, and there were so many highlights of season one, he said sarcastically.
I was saying, not a lot of people say that, but
that, but I think Geordi's, you know, sort of character arc in season one was, I thought, very well done, because he was left in command a couple of times, and he was, and he did grow quite a bit as a commander. And I loved seeing that before he got moved to engineering. So if Argyle or any of the other engineers had been able to, you know, to hold on to their job down there, we might have been seeing Geordi LaForge as the ship's long-term helmsman and future captain. But I really did like his story arc in season one. If those of you have maybe are doing a rewatch and you're going through season one, I would kind of recommend keeping an eye on that, because I thought that was really, really one of the bright spots of the first season of TNG.
And, you know, I think it makes natural sense that he did eventually move to engineering and become the chief engineer, because what does he do when, you know, his captain makes a comment about the engine? He re-engineers he it.
Yeah, I think he definitely had a an affinity towards that.
Yeah. And that's another nice thing about Starfleet that we saw in Lower Decks, actually, with Rutherford and his journey, trying to find his right fit. And where all the different departments were so open to him finding the place where he fit best, you know, baby bear.
that was all when he was trying security and stuff. And I loved when he was like,
oh my God,
you mean there's a holograph, there's a simulated Billups in there, and I can say anything I want to him.
Oh, so excited for Lower Decks to come back in Vegas. Yep,
that's going to be awesome. And we've got that. And then I've got some more Lower Decks notes later on. When we're talking about Lavelle, so we can jump down to that later. So I think Chief O'Brien, I think at that point, mm-hmm. he was just sort of like unnamed flight control officer at that point, because he right. showed up as early, if I remember right. He was, you know, in the battle bridge, I think, in Encounter at Farpoint. And he was, you know, one of the front stations. But it was a while before we really got to know who he was and what he did.
Right.
And I think he definitely bounced around kind of like a almost like an extra for a little while before we really got to know him.
And he occasionally had an extra piece of corn on his collar.
He did. So. There was something going on there before they kind of realigned the pips. And the enlisted ranks. But, you know, I don't know how he was as a helmsman, but I think it is canon at this point that he's the most important officer in the history of Starfleet, right?
That is true. That is official. So
definitely we're going to kind of pluck him out of this list and put him on his own special category for
there
that.
You go.
And I kind of forgot until you brought this up that that Worf was on the command track too, until the unfortunate events of Tasha Yar's demise with
right,
Armus.
Right. Yeah. So Worf had an interesting career path, because he started on the command track, went to tactical, then by Deep Space Nine went back to the command track.
He when he joined Deep Space Nine, and you saw him at the end of Way of the Warrior come up the elevator in the Deep Space Nine uniform with the red trim, that looked fantastic to me. I mean, to me, that just looked like the look Worf should have had from the get-go.
Yeah.
So we've got a bunch. I mean, so many on here.
Right. We have a lot of kind of one-offs. We have Poor Judgment by a Lieutenant Torres who pulled his phaser on a cue.
Yeah. So you can't, if you're going to be a helmsman and a future captain, you've got to use good judgment. Pulling your phaser on a cue, man, that's right. Just going to get you frozen right off the bat.
Yeah. That's TOS reflexes there. And we're in TNG now. We got to put the phaser down.
Although, you know, Worf was pretty quick on the draw also for most of his time as a security officer. I think I'm sure we've all seen the video of Worf just getting tossed around.
getting shot down by Picard over and over again. And over. Yeah. Yeah, quite a few one-offs. We did have, actually, speaking of Chief O'Brien, early on when he was kind of an extra bouncing around from position to position, Lieutenant Junior Grade Jay.
Lieutenant Jay.
Yeah, played by a friend of the network, Tracy Lee Coco. She actually served at the helm for a little bit.
I remember seeing her in the back. I had to actually, you know, kind of look it up to see that she was, you know, a flight control officer from time to time. Mm-hmm. But you're right, friend of the show, and would love to see her character revived on Lower Decks or somewhere.
That would be so awesome.
A new Trek.
That would be so awesome.
I know we were pushing that on Twitter a little bit, just, you know, with a hashtag, but would love to see Tracy there. Yes. We had a chance to meet late last year, I believe it was, mm-hmm. at a convention here in Indianapolis that we went to. It's called Starbase Indy. And she was there as a special guest of Barfleet. Barfleet is a network of, I think it's in 8 different cities, and they're organized by ships. It's Boston, New York, a bunch around the Midwest, and I think there might be one or so out west. And the one in Indianapolis, the ship's name is Indecent, like Indecent. So I got invited to their after party, and Tracy was there, and it was good. I mean, they did a good job. They closed up all the windows. They took everybody's cell phones. There were no cameras. There were no recordings of this.
Great.
There was a DJ. Actually, Rod Roddenberry popped in for a little bit because their longtime captain was moving up to a kind of a national leadership position. So it was kind of a changing of the guard there. So that was really, really a cool thing to see. And Tracy was there also. So I'd love to see her, you know, back in one of the new Star Trek series.
Well, I had asked her in preparation for this episode, I'm like, Tracy, did Lieutenant J, did she ever fly the Enterprise? Was she ever at the helm? And her response was, I was everywhere. We'll count her as a flight control officer.
And I think her background was in like body, like stunt work, right? And she was mm-hmm. essentially, you know, there for that, but then also filled in at different stations at different times, kind of like Billy Blackburn did on the original series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was everywhere.
Sometimes he was there, and then he wasn't there, and then he was back there.
That's right. Killed in one episode, back in the next.
Or in one scene, out of one scene, back in the scene. What?
So, yeah, quite a few one-offs in the position. But then we really had probably, I would say, 2 well-known flight control officers aboard the Enterprise D, the 2 that really stuck. Am I forgetting one?
Well, I think we're talking Wesley Crusher. And I think we're talking Ensign Roe Laren. But let's dig into this, though, a little bit, because I knew that we had one that often didn't get a line, often didn't get a lot of camera time, but was in so many episodes. And that's Ensign Gates. She was in 46 episodes.
46. Well,
give her one more, people.
I know.
Proving that not everything is 47. So definitely wanted to give that a shout out, because I'll say notorious is the best word for Ensign Roe, as notorious as she is. 8 episodes. Mm-hmm. That's it. Yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
Could have had her own series. Didn't want it. But 8 mm-hmm. episodes, which is exactly the same number of episodes, I believe, as Yeoman Rand was in the original series. She was only in 8
really?
Episodes. Yeah. And then back for a couple of movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So Ensign Gates, maybe we can get her into Lower Decks, round out that perfect 47.
Oh, that would be fantastic. So you want to talk about Wesley first?
Sure. Let's talk about good old Wesley.
You know, I think Wesley really, really, at least in the beginning, before he quit, right? Because let's face it, ultimately, you know, he quits. And then he comes back, but let's not talk about that. Yeah, no spoilers in case anybody hasn't seen the new stuff yet. But he tried so hard. He was, I'm Starfleet. I don't lie, right? Like he tried so hard to kind of exemplify those traits, those qualities that, you know, Starfleet is, you know, prides itself on. And I think he was definitely a competent helmsman. I think he had Captain Picard to tutor him and mentor him, and he was more than willing to learn. And I think of the next gen era helmsman, like that's kind of who I think of more often than not is Wesley Crusher mm-hmm. in that position, because of all the other, and we probably have 30. I mean, if you go to Memory Alpha, you can probably find 30 or so, 20 to 30, I'll say, people that were in that station, so many of them for one episode and only one episode, so many without even really a line other than II Captain. Mm-hmm. And we've got Wesley, who is, you know, an active part of the crew that will, you know, not necessarily question orders, but will clarify orders if he needs to, that offers right. things and, you know, does do a little bit of flossing and flying that mofo all around. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. He was in 68 episodes, if I'm correct on that. He does exemplify a lot of the characteristics that we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier. I mean, obviously he's a teenager when he says, you know, I'm Starfleet, we don't lie. But he already knows at that age that Starfleet officers should be known for their integrity and their character. And he really does try to do the right thing. He gets, of course, the big lesson in doing the right thing in the first duty.
He does. And there it's just conflicted because he's trying to do, you know, he's trying to stand by his team, right? Nova Squadron is also trying to stand by, you know, the bigger picture integrity that mm-hmm. that he needs to live up to. And it is one of those things that when you're in that position, I think for the first time where you have to make that decision, whether or not you're going to be the person you say you are, even though it's really, 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 really hard at that point, you're going to do it anyway, or you're going to try to compromise your values. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned really, and I hate to say it, but I've learned it from Star Trek, is that if you're willing to compromise your principles in a challenging situation, were they ever really your principles to begin with?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's what Wesley learned there, because they could have gotten away from it, or they could. I was about to start quoting Scooby-Doo. We could have gotten away with it if it weren't for you kids.
It wasn't for that meddling captain.
That meddling Wesley. They could have gotten away with it. Granted, with a question mark, you know, mm-hmm. everyone was suspicious, but they could have gotten away with it had Wesley not spoken up. And Wesley, yeah, like you said, he actually had to examine his principles. And if they were truly his principles, he needed to say something, and he did. Boy, he was in a tough situation there. And I wonder how much that soured his view of Starfleet, or maybe it was the wake-up call that he needed all along, because his whole life, he basically, the expectation was, well, you're gonna grow up and go into Starfleet. Right. And now maybe for the first time, he saw that, well, maybe it's not everything that it, you know, that it's cracked up to be, but yeah, he definitely consistently displayed those characteristics.
And I think he had a much more interesting character arc than he's maybe often given credit for, you know, just mm-hmm. all the shut up Wesley memes and montages we've seen around.
Yeah.
because he does go from, you know, bright eyed little kid to, you know, somewhat dour, disillusioned, you know, young adult. And mm-hmm. kind of does go from the path that is expected from him to finding his own path. Yeah. And, you know, it's amazing because all of this was somewhat foreshadowed very early on by the time, by the Traveler, when he said, hey, Wesley is different. He's brilliant. He's going to find his own way. And I thought that was another, you know, high point to early Next Gen.
So we have a theory here on Galaxy Class that I believe it was Pierre Larocco who first came up with this, that Jack Crusher was actually a traveler. And so Wesley, you know, is part traveler, mm-hmm. kind of like Ben Sisko is part prophet. And Will Wheaton was at Mission Chicago. And, you know, I went up to just to meet him, whatever. And I wanted to tell him our theory. And I didn't. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to be that dork that's trying to talk about, you know, Star Trek stuff with the actor.
At Mission Chicago, though, I think that's fair game.
And then it wasn't, 2 weeks later, when a certain episode of a certain series aired with a certain somebody making a certain return as a certain something. And I'm just kicking myself because I should have said something to him and see if he cracked. But
you know what? God love him for spoiling hindsight. Nothing, because when that certain somebody did appear on that certain series, I wept. I did.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
It just the kind of the years of, you know, his personal journey that he shares on the Ready Room and just to be kind of recognized mm-hmm. for, you know, being part of the family that he is. I thought that was amazing. And at this point, we could probably give up on
the entire scene,
on pretending not to spoil it, anything.
I screamed through that whole scene. I thought, I'm amazed my neighbors didn't call the cops, but now I sold the house. It doesn't matter. Anyway. Yeah. Wesley Crusher. So we actually had a poll on the BQN Collective asking you, the listeners, who your favorite helmsfolk, I think, is that the non-gender term, helmsfolk and pilot depicted in TNG. And Wesley Crusher came in second. Believe it or not, our big winner was the aforementioned Would you say eight episodes worth
of Ro Laren? Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, she made quite an impression, apparently. And I think she comes at it almost from the opposite side of Wesley, at least when we first see her in Starfleet. Because you've got Wesley who's wide-eyed and Starfleet to the core. And then you have Ro who comes in bitter, disillusioned. Definitely not Starfleet to the core.
Yeah, I did a little brief synopsis of her eight episodes. Season five is where she came along. Ensign Ro is the name of the episode. We meet her and she is intolerable. Disaster puts Troy in command on the bridge, trying to find a way to save everybody on board. Ro wants to cut and run, get rid of him, kill all the other people on board, and is theretofore also intolerable. Conundrum, she forgets how intolerable she is and becomes somewhat tolerable. Power play was where O'Brien and two others kind of get taken over. And she tries to stop O'Brien from taking over the ship, but fails. But then she helps Geordi get the ship back using a plasma pulse to kind of exercise those folks. And that's the beginning of maybe a little prelude to a little future buddy romp she has with Geordi. We have cause and effect where Ro at the helm lets the Bozeman crash into the Enterprise like nine times. Also not great piloting. You can also probably tell that I didn't vote for Ensign Ro as my favorite helmsman.
No.
We have the next phase, which Geordi and Ro phase out of normal space. They're running around. They can pass through walls, but they don't pass through the floor for some reason. I don't really get it. But if it was up to Ro, they never would have made it back because she was just like, hey, we're Bajoran spirits now. Yay.
We're with the prophet.
And then in Rascals, she drove the shuttle into an energy anomaly. A better helmsman would have missed it. It's kind of like Sully gets all this credit, you know, for hitting the birds. I like to be like Matt Damon in 30 Rock, or he's like, you know who I am? I'm the guy that misses the birds. I did awesome. Like the ending of Rascals where she was like, you know, I just want to stay a child a little longer so I can enjoy my childhood for once. And then the last time we see her is Preemptive Strike, where she goes to kind of go undercover with the Maquis and tries to basically, which I thought was very un-Star Trek like, where the Federation was waiting, Starfleet was just waiting to just basically commit genocide on the Maquis. And I think honestly that Ro did the right thing and kind of gave them a chance to escape with their lives. And then she ended up joining the Maquis. So our two favorite filmsmen both quit.
yeah
and we're talking exactly. about this great command track that it is, and they yep. both left.
I gotta say your synopsis of Ro is hilarious. Absolutely hilarious.
Now I will say this, other people are gonna probably look at Ensign Ro and see you know, a very strong woman who is not willing to put up with, you know, undue or unfair treatment. And she's willing to stand up for herself, and she's very strong, and she has a lot of character, and she's they feel represented very, very well. So all kidding aside, like if you see yourself represented by that character, God love you, because we all want to be represented and we all want to have somebody that we can relate to when we're watching shows like this. You know, my whole life, I've found people that I could relate to, other people, not so much. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, if a strong woman comes on the show and you can relate to them and that means something to you, I thank. It just makes me more proud of my fandom that there's somebody there that other people can relate to. I was just having a little fun with her.
Well, if you remember back to our Ensign Ro profile, I relate to any woman whose sleeves are always too short because they cut women's clothing for Tyrannosaurus Rexes, yeah. apparently. But no, you know, that's kind of a thing with TNG, with the flight control officers. Seems like they'll stick a character there because you're on the bridge and you can see them and you can have stories and character development and that kind of thing. But you're right. Was Ro actually a good pilot? She did seem to crash into a lot of things. And like collision avoidance, right? That's a thing, right? That's something I'm going to be learning. So note to self, you know, don't crash into the Bozeman and other anomalies.
Yeah, there were. Now, granted, it was the same crash nine times. There was no way to kind of learn from it. But I think Data was the only one that was learning very, very slowly. But did we talk about Picard and Riker at all? As far as being former?
Not in any detail.
So we have Picard. Now we all know the Picard maneuver when he kind of gets up and straightens his uniform.
That's right.
But there was also the Picard maneuver when he was helmsman on the Stargazer, where he kind of went to warp for, and forgive me if I've got this wrong, but he goes to warp for a short distance and it made the Enterprise look, sorry, the Stargazer look like it was in two different places at the same time. So that the enemy was shooting at the wrong one and they were able to succeed and be victorious, or at least get away. So that was the Picard maneuver. So he was obviously a pretty, pretty hot helmsman. And did he not also manually fly the Enterprise like through some asteroid field or something like that in one of the episodes where the computer couldn't do it, but he did. So
he flew a shuttlecraft that the Enterprise followed, right? Was that what it was?
Something like that.
Oh, but my gosh.
Was, yeah, he yeah, was, you're he right. was definitely had his chops as a helmsman. Mm-hmm. And then you got Riker, who we didn't really talk much about in the series as far as being this like awesome pilot until it became a plot point in Chain of Command when Captain Jellico was like, hey, Geordi, I need somebody to pilot this shuttlecraft. And he was like, hey, if you want the best, you got to go to Will Riker. He's the best. And then actually Riker was kind of intolerable at that point also, because he was like, why don't you just ask me? You know, it's like, well, I mean, come on, man. The old man's already in your office. He's eating crow already. You know, he's laying it out. Just, you know, just kind of meet him halfway, you know? And also I'm not saying Jellico was awesome. And I think Joe Keegan will probably have me for this, but you know, he came on the ship. He was enthusiastic. He knew Riker. He knew his background. He knew all the personnel. At least he'd read their files. He had an agenda. He had a plan. He didn't have a lot of time to build a team and just kind of like jumped in and kind of wanted to get things done. You know, and he wanted a fourth shift. Okay. You know, a guy wants a fourth shift. Give him the fourth shift. You don't have to fight him on everything.
You know, it's temporary. Picard will be back if he doesn't get killed.
But yeah, so at that point, that was kind of when I was introduced, I think, for the first time to the thought that, you know, Riker was formerly a helmsman and was a, a Sierra Hotel pilot. And there was, and that was cool.
Yeah, I think that was the first mention.
And then we saw that again in, you know, he worked in, as a pilot specifically in The Outcast when they worked together there.
When he worked with Soren.
And great episode. Although, you know, Jonathan Frakes often talks about how it didn't go far enough and he's, you know, disappointed with that. But I think just the, you know, for the time, I think they were doing the best they could.
And what's the name of the episode where they introduced the Trill?
Trill.
I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah,
was it called Trill?
No, or was it called The Host?
Oh, maybe it was called The Host. The one where, of course, Beverly falls in love with...
The Trill.
Yeah. Odan was his name. But we had Riker piloting Odan's shuttle, which it turned out, you know, worked out perfectly because when Odan was injured, then they put the symbiont into Riker.
So Beverly again, was like, I don't like that much.
I mean, she gave it a try. You know, you got to give her props for that. But then, of course, in Star Trek Insurrection...
Oh yeah,
the infamous joystick.
So, oh my God, I love that scene, and it is one of my favorites. And I believe the ops officer's name was named something. I think Stephanie Nuznick was the actor's name, and sadly, we lost her a couple of years ago. I believe in 2020, maybe 2019. But that scene where he said to Geordi, "All right, what's in this nebula?" And Geordi's like, Metreon gas, it's really unstable. I wouldn't go near it. He's like, I want to go through it. I want to ram it down the sonar's throat. and then he engages the manual control column, the manual steering column, it was called. Which, you know what? Like I don't know what, you know, 24th century touchscreens are going to be like, but I know when I'm operating a 21st century touchscreen, sometimes I don't touch exactly what I want, or sometimes I kind of like swipe my hand across and, you know, kind of touch something inadvertently. And they've got these giant touchscreens and they're gorgeous. And I think they're, you know, I think Mike and Denise Okuda had a hand in them. I think Doug Drexler had a hand in designing them. They're absolutely gorgeous, but you're flying the ship by, you know, touching buttons, you know, kind of in all these disparate locations. Just give me a stick and a thrust lever, man. That's all I want. And that's what Riker got with the manual control column. And he was able to perform also what is known as the Riker maneuver. And I'm not talking about like, you know, the Riker maneuver that we all know when he steps over a chair, but history is going to remember that as the Riker maneuver if it works.
Exactly. And I never thought about the touchscreens until Discovery came out. And of course the big, I don't know, outrage among the fans was, oh, this takes place before the original series, but the ships are more advanced and they've all got the touchscreens and all that. But I heard a fan like a fan theory or kind of someone's headcanon was that they realized that, you know, you hit turbulence and all that, and you've got the touchscreen and your finger misses the button, whatever. So that's why by the time of TOS, they went to the jelly bean, you know, and the levers and the buttons and the controls, because you can feel them. It's like driving down the highway in your big old truck with your touchscreen and you're trying to change a radio station. And the next thing you know, it ends up on like contemporary pop country or something by accident because you hit a bump or something, versus the old days where you turn the knob and you always got the right station.
I get it. That's one. And then there's also the whole, what would they have done on TOS if they had the budget and the technology to do it? So,
yeah.
I mean, for me, it's all about this. It's all about the stories, and it's all about, you know, how can I watch people model behavior and model decision-making that's going to help us, help me be better humans.
Yes.
While the talk like that is fun, it's also, you know, not really what I'm in it for. I did like the 32nd century programmable matter, I think it was, with the, you know, kind of the handles that came up out of the home station that they were able to use on that show. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And apparently they were sort of intuitive enough that your brain had kind of a hand in designing what they would look like and how they would feel, so that it would be, you know, intuitive to you, which I thought that was fascinating. I wish that would be the truth on the plane that I flew. Or that I fly now, because sometimes it's a little bit, I don't know, just, you know, depending on loading and stuff like that. Sometimes it's heavy, sometimes it's light, sometimes it's whatever. But if it could just be whatever I wanted it to be all the time, that would be fantastic.
And I really liked what Rios had on the La Serena with just like these 3D controls that would come up, and he was just, you know, listeners, I'm making wild art gestures that aren't coming across in this audio.
She is,
podcast.
But she's doing them really, really well. She looks just like Rios, who by the way was is dare we spoil anything else? My favorite character from Picard.
Oh gosh, yeah.
But many we had many versions of Rios, so it was good to see him.
And each one was just delightful.
They were. It was good. It was good stuff.
And going back to Picard, in Picard, trying to fly the La Serena. I think it was the end of season one, one of the latter episodes, and he sits in there, and then all the 3D electronics pop up, and he's like,
"Yeah, it's like watching, you know, watching me try to work an iPhone."
Yeah, yeah, but you know, that's why you go to training for your new.
It's true.
You know,
I mean, it really is true, and basically the you know, the kind of airplane I'm flying now has its roots in technology in the 60s, even though it's been updated, you know, time and time and time and time again, you know. But if you look at Boeing aircraft, you know, from the 707 to the 727, 37, 707 started in 1959. The 727 started, you know, first flew in 63, and the 737 first flew in about 65, 66, 67, something like that, depending on if you're.
Okay, just for context, Star Trek, the original series, first aired shortly after the 737.
Yeah, 1966. So sometime in that area between, you know, flight testing and first commercial use and stuff like that. So that was there. Now it's a far cry from what it was. It's basically a tube with, you know, two engines and, you know, underneath two wings. So the configuration is somewhat unchanged. But, you know, everything that's under the hood and, you know, in the, on the flight deck is new and updated in many, many ways. But 747, same thing, that came out in 1970. 757, 767, both came out in 1982, 83.
Rathacon era.
So all of these airplanes, even the 777 came out in 1995. So that's going on 30 years old. So all of these airplanes are very, have technology that's older, that's been adapted, kind of is my point, and updated. And don't, you know, fear not, folks, you're not, you know, if you ride on a United, you know, a major US airline, and you hop on any one of these Boeing airplanes, you're not getting on a 50-year-old plane. You're getting on a brand new plane that just came off the assembly line. It just, it's the roots of the technology. It's you know, standing on the shoulders of technology that's proven and was developed back then.
And if Boeing gets to update their technology and what's under the hood and their flight controls from the 60s to the 2020s, then I think Star Trek can do that too.
Yeah, they sure can.
If your head cannon has a problem with it.
Yep. They're always, always going in for overhauls. In fact, that's the whole reason the Enterprise incident, right? The ship was due for an overhaul, 6 months ago. That's why I wandered into the Romulan neutral zone.
Yeah. Oops. Darn it. Accidentally walked out with your cloaking device. Hate when captains go crazy. Well, crazy Captain Mike, any final thoughts on TNG at the helm and flight control officers?
Well, just to summarize what we were saying, you know, it's just, you know, before you've got to walk before you can run, and, you know, moving your way up through the ranks to go from learning the ropes, building experience, not building kind of a knowledge base to be able to make sound decisions, and being, you know, right there, you know, kind of literally in the shadow of the captain of the ship is a great way to learn and sort of plan your future to become a great captain one day. And I think that even though our two favorite helms people both ended up quitting Starfleet, we can both see that they had the opportunity to someday go on and be good captains. And I'm sure those other folks did go on to, you know, mm-hmm. they, you know, many of them were either frozen or killed by the Scimitar, or also might've gotten killed during disaster, whatever may have happened. I think the helms people were mm-hmm. definitely the red shirts of the next gen era, because there were so many of them.
Yeah.
But needless to say, they were in the right place to become great captains someday. And that kind of building block, that, you know, that ladder of, you know, learning, you know, honing your craft, being the best sort of individual technical expert you can be before moving up to, you know, a leadership role and a servant leadership role, and then kind of a guardian leadership role, is kind of all wrapped up in that command track. And I think it's done very well on Next Gen. I really do.
That's awesome. Mike, absolutely appreciate your input here.
And I can't say just how excited I am for you and your journey and what you're going to be going on. And, you know, anything that I can do to help, or any questions that you could have, I can point you in the right direction, because it's, I'm not going to have the answers, but I know a bunch of people that have been in the industry and have been in training for a long, long time, and just really, really excited for what's in store for you going forward.
Oh, thank you. And, you know, Amy says this all the time, and it's so true, about how Star Trek people are the best people. And, you know, you and I met, I think the first time we met was I heard you on Mission Log Live, and you were talking about being in the airline industry, and I was all excited, and I like sent you a message, and you replied,
exactly,
you know, and, you know, we've been in, you know, communication the last year or so as I've been kind of chasing down this dream, and I've learned a lot from you already before even starting flight school. So yeah, you know, Star Trek people are the best, and I just appreciate everything that you've done for me. And I know that you will, you know, I'm going to continue to lean on you over the next few years.
And feel free to. I think if you're a fan of this kind of not just the genre of science fiction, if you're a fan of Star Trek in particular, then there's something about that moral and ethical code that attracts you to it. And I think that's what makes mm-hmm. Star Trek people good people, overwhelmingly so.
Yeah, would Gene have ever thought that what he created would bring people together like this? It's just beyond cool. So, Mike, where can people find you on the interwebs and otherwise?
Well, you can find me on the Roddenberry Podcast Network on Mission Log The Orville, where we do a deep dive into every episode of Seth MacFarlane's The Orville, looking for messages, morals, and meanings, and to see if that show does, you know, kind of live up to and align with the Roddenberry Star Trek philosophy. We're just finishing up season 3, The Orville New Horizons, right now. And you can also, if you're more of a YouTube watcher, the videos are available on the Roddenberry YouTube network as well. On Twitter, I'm at mrichards1701. And I'm also mike.ml_TheOrville on Instagram. A little clunky, but it was the best I could do. And Rhea, when you're not selling all your stuff and moving out of your house and getting ready to start flight school, where can people find you?
Well, I do have a rather limited social media presence. Otherwise, you can find me on the BQN Collective, usually posting silly memes. And of course, co-hosting Galaxy Class with, you know, some of my favorite Star Trek people.
Previously on BQN. All Good Things, a Star Trek Universe podcast.
As somebody that went through the D.A.R.E. program, I just feel in Nancy Reagan and all of that, like I grew up in that generation. And I've, as an adult, realized that, yes, there are people that abuse drugs, and drugs are not for everybody. But drugs are for some people.
Infinite Diversity, a Star Trek Universe podcast.
I love that Pike cooks with cast iron, because I truly could not imagine him using any other kind of pans.
I didn't even notice that.
It's just that's a very cast iron. in character thing for him to cook on, like, this, you know, seasoned cast iron. It's probably like 300 years old, and I'm sure, yeah.
Galaxy Class, a Star Trek The Next Generation podcast.
Wouldn't it be fun if we got a series that was like Star Trek JAG, where every episode was like a law, like a some kind of legal case that that ran up against Starfleet general orders or directives?
Yes! Oh my gosh, we need to have that!
Yeah.
You will find these and more of your favorite podcasts on BQN.
Incoming transmission.
We would love to hear what you thought of today's episode and hope you'll join our Facebook group, the BQN Collective, to continue our discussion there. You can also tweet your thoughts at Galaxy Class Pod. We would love for you to reach out. Or you can follow the network on Twitter and Instagram at BQN Podcasts. Please hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a star rating and written review. That helps others to find the show.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. We're putting out even more exclusive content for our patrons, like It's Green and Amy's Math Moments, that you won't want to miss. With a monthly Patreon subscription of $5 or more, you can join our meetings of the Hive Mind on the second Saturday of each month. Watch your Patreon messages for details. If you feel so inclined, please check out all the details at patreon.com/BQN. A huge shout out to our very own associate producer, Jim McMahon. You might have heard of him, Trivia with Jim. We are so grateful for your support. We also want to thank our executive producers who make all this possible. They are Mark White, Amy Nelson, Tony Robinson, and Ken Tripp. A special thanks to Tony Robinson for our wonderful artwork week after week. Thank you for beaming aboard the Galaxy Class, and until next time, stay classy, Galaxy.
Engage.